Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I review it and stick it out. Actually, the last book, or after the last book that I reviewed, I've read two books since then, except one of them was a fantasy book, which was actually quite fun to read. As you probably know, picked up, I work quite a lot as an entertainer on cruise ships, and there was this other entertainer who was on with me. He was a magician called John Lenehan, and he was saying, "Oh yeah, I'm doing this," and he's dyslexic, but he says, "Yeah, I'm also a novelist." And I thought, oh, that was interesting, but I didn't mention anything at the time. And I later on, about half an hour later, I mentioned that I was also writing a novel at the moment for the National Novel Writing Month, and so we got chatting, and it turns out he's actually got a novel of his own published. It's called Shadow Magic. And it's a young adult fantasy book. And he gave me a copy because, of course, he carries them around with him. He's currently working on the third in the series. I think the second in the series is being published. And he actually decided to release his... Because he wrote the novel, first of all, and shopped it around, didn't get much interest, and then put it up on Podio Books. So you can actually listen to the whole thing on podiobooks.com as a podcast with him reading it. I haven't actually checked it out myself. I just read the book as it was. So there you go. And actually another book that I said I was going to be reviewing, which is The Seventh Son, the first Seventh Son book, is also up there for free as well on podiobooks.com. That's where that was first broadcast. And there, those two are generally rated the top two books. So I'm probably going to actually get round to reading Seventh Son, although, like I say, I only have it as a PDF, not as an ebook. But maybe I'll check it out as a podcast, because John Lenehan, this other author on Podio Books, says it's really worth checking out. So anyway, that was a good book. And then what else have we done? Oh yeah, the National Novel Writing Month for myself, not really going so well. Actually, I'm really pleased with what I've written so far. It's just I've been really busy with another project, a video project that I've been working on all year. It's a video of me juggling in every country that I visited, about 40 different countries around the world, in the style of like the Where the Hell Is Matt dancing video. And I'm going to be releasing that in maybe about a week's time. So I've been working a lot on that over the last week. So I've not done very much writing at all. Even, like I say, I'm happy with where the story is going. It's just I know I'm probably not going to get 50,000 words written by the end of the month. I did get quite a bit of feedback, actually, from the last episode that I did, where I mentioned at the end, hey, what I'm thinking of doing is maybe reading the Atlas Shrugged novel. And six people emailed me saying, don't read that novel, it's not worth it, read something else instead. And that's why I checked out these other books. And that's why I, in the same shelf, or the next shelf over, in the library here on the cruise ship that I'm working on, I found this book that I'm going to review today. And of course, you've already seen the title when you downloaded this, or when it came through on iTunes. It's The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. I've not actually read it for many years, but I remember getting a little bit bored there's like a trilogy of five books. And by the time I was getting through to book four, I'm not even sure if I ever bothered to read book five. It's getting a little bit bored with it, with sequel fatigue, as I call it. But I thought, hey, I'll give this a go. And also, it's on the Geek Nights podcast. They have a book club, and it's their book as well. So I thought, hey, I might as well just check it out. Normally check out some of their recommendations, although one of them was Snow Crash. A bit of background with me, this novel. I have read it a few times before. This is, I think, my third, maybe, no, definitely at least the third time I've read it. And what really annoys me about this book is that I hate the hype about it, because it's so much, people call it like a cult classic, but it's not a cult classic. You know, you had like movies and loads of other stuff made out of it like that. It's definitely part of like mainstream. But it just gets so boring. You know, I move in different circles. Lots of jugglers, of course, read this book, and lots of geeks read this book as well. Not saying that I'm a geek or anything, but, you know, I do come across it online over and over again, and in real life over and over again, people talking about the number 42 and the meaning of life and all that kind of stuff. And it bores me to tears, because when it comes to these kind of things, I really want like a little bit more. Like, if I mention the meaning of life and someone just says 42, it's sort of like, it's just boring. And it's like a shortcut into, you know, social acceptance, and it's like a shortcut to like, easy comedy. You know, once I mentioned about like the intelligence of dolphins, and someone will go, "Oh yeah, but mice are more intelligent." And it's just like, oh, for goodness sake, it's just a book. It's just so I was really like not sure if I was going to really get into this or not. This book or not? I guess you'll have to wait till the end of the review if I say I've really enjoyed it or not. A bit about the edition that I'm reading here. This is the 25th anniversary edition. And it's like this, it says, this is the illustrated collector's edition. So you've actually got like maybe 100 pages of the background of the story of how it was written and the production of the radio show and the different scripts and then the then being turned into a book as well. So you've got like 100 pages and lots of pictures there. And then when you should get into the book itself, it's a square book. If you actually check out, because I'm including now the photo of the book I'm reading as the art for the MP3. So it's a square book, but when you actually open the pages, you actually have like the center of the pages is like a white oblong around about the same size as say like a normal paperback book, and then around the outside of that you get these illustrations with this sort of circular pixelated art with sort of brown ink on blue paper. And it's a little bit weird to read it that way, but actually I found it quite easy because it's sort of like the book. There's so much more paper in the book around the edges of the text is that you can read it. It's like a big chunky hardback book, but you can read it just by holding it, and your thumbs don't get away in the way of the text. I actually think more books should be done in this way. Of course, they're not because you know, it's the wrong size to fit on shelves and cost too much to produce books like this. But it was actually quite an interesting read. And also, it's actually quite fun to read about the history of a novel beforehand. But again, I didn't actually read this history before I get into it. I sort of knew the roundabout way where this book came from, but it was actually only when I finished the book that I read it, and a lot of things were explained. Anyway, so moving on to the actual book itself, written in, I guess, 1978. It's a radio play beforehand, but the actual book was released in 1979 as a novel, and it's actually quite a short book, maybe like 200 pages long as a normal paperback book, so it's actually a very easy read. The world of the book, it's set in a kind of it's a bit strange really, because it's I guess you could call it like a space opera, because there's sort of like a galaxy-wide civilization with starships and aliens and all that kind of stuff, so you've got that kind of stuff going on there, but it's never really explained sort of like the political underpinnings and stuff like that. You know, you get the president and it's sort of like, oh yeah, the president is just there, everything, because it's like a comedy and it's a satire and everything is just there. If it gets a laugh, you know, if it's a funny story, it's a funny bit of backstory, if it's a funny explanation, it's in the book. And it doesn't actually have to make any sense at all, as long as it's funny and it always has a comment on humanity or society or anything like that. And the name of the book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, is actually a book within the book. It's actually an electronic book, a bit like a Kindle with, you know, because it's like stored like an encyclopedia, like a travel guide, an encyclopedia to the entire galaxy, stored on a Kindle that you know, it's in a case and you flick it on, you flick through the pages, that kind of thing. And actually, I wrote this down here. Let me flick forward to page 207 because I made a note here. This is what it says about the editing of the book itself. It goes like this. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a very unevenly edited book and contains many passages that simply seemed to its editors like a good idea at the time. And this is actually an explanation, and then it goes on to sort of a story that is in, you know, one of the characters is reading a story from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the book, but it just sounds a little bit funny, and it does explain the world. The thing is, that's what this book is. I mean, that's what The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is in the novel, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But that's also what The Hitchhiker's Galaxy is itself as a novel. It's just a collection of ideas that seem like a good idea at the time to Douglas Adams, or it's some funny little thing, or it sounds interesting, and it's just put in there. And if it's not really interesting, or if it doesn't need to be interesting, or it doesn't need to be, it's just not in there at all. So there's so much stuff that goes unexplained. But generally, I can say it's a comedy space opera. That's all you need to know, really, with hyperdrives and ultra mahogany and all these other science fiction kind of terms, which don't make any sense in of themselves. It's just techno babble and things like that. So that's what the book is. The plot itself follows two main threads at the beginning that coalesce into one main thread. First of all, you've got Arthur Dent. He is our human Earthman protagonist who it actually starts off with him realizing that his house is going to be demolished and him trying to stop his house being demolished by the bulldozers coming in. And yet at the same time, the Vogon destruction fleet, which is the alien destruction fleet, comes in and has to demolish the Earth for the same reason. Because, you know, Arthur's house is going to be knocked down to build a bypass, to build a motorway around the town that he lives in, or lives next to, I guess. And the Vogons are going to destroy the Earth for a hyperspace expressway or something like that. So that's the kind of setup that you've got there. And with the help of his friend called Ford Prefect, he manages to get off the Earth in an interesting way. And that then starts the book. And they've got to then hop from spaceship to spaceship and from planet to the next planet. And, you know, from Earth to, you know, trying to find their way around the galaxy. Meanwhile, there's another thread of the story, which is Zaphod Beetlebrox, I guess his name is, and again, it's one of these names which you sort of hear pronounced and you sort of look at a bit. And you're never quite sure exactly what you're reading with a lot of these names. You think, what, it's Starty Blarty Fart Fast or something like that. You're never quite sure what the names are. They're all stupid comedy names. Anyway, he's the president of the galaxy, and him and his girlfriend, they pretty much steal a spaceship and take it away. And then, of course, later on in the book, these two groups meet up. Zaphod and Trillian and Arthur and Ford meet up, and they go on more adventures. Now, the thing about this plot is that it's very, sort of, I could say episodic, but then it's not very episodic. It was adapted from a radio series, and after reading about it, you can see it says it's actually the story of the first four episodes. So actually, you pretty much have it like set up into these into these like four sections, I guess, roughly, which makes it a very disjointed read, because nothing about the, say, third episode is mentioned in the first one, and nothing about the fourth is mentioned in the second, you know, so it's only what you need at the time is being presented to you. So, like, the first chapter is the escape from Earth of Arthur and Ford, and then, you know, the second is sort of like the group is forming up and we get their backstories and things, and then the third is that they go into this mystery planet, and then the fourth is they discover the answer to, you know, the situation, a bit more of the backstory about why Earth is being destroyed, or and the secrets behind it, and of course the mystery to life, the universe and everything, the big question is answered as well by the end of the book. But overall, it's meandering. But it doesn't even meandering. It's like a straight course. But you can see that, like, when Douglas Adams was writing that first episode, he didn't really know where the story was going to be at the end of the series, or even at the end of the book when he was writing the book. It's a very, very strange kind of setup, and it does leave you hanging at the end. The plot is very much the weakest element of this book, or one of the weakest elements of this book, let me say it there, and it's full of so many plot holes. I mean, literally, you're just reading it and going, well, that wouldn't happen, well, that wouldn't happen, well, that wouldn't happen. But the thing is, it's not meant to be about the plot. It is definitely, like I just said before, it's edited together. Wait a second, let me flick back to page 207, because it was written here as well. It's just lots of many passages that simply seemed to its editor / writer like a good idea at the time, and so that's what you're getting. So moving on to the characters, I guess there's there's four main characters. And actually, all of the characters in the book have, like, a set of very, very similar characteristics. They're all very talkative, they're all very witty, they're all very funny. They're all very happy all of the time, or they seem to be happy with any situation that they get into, or always lighthearted, let me put it that way. They're always confused about where they are, but they're always very gullible. You know, they just take it what it is, and they're not very curious. Or they are slightly curious, but not really curious. But then again, they can't be curious, because in the galaxy, which makes no sense, you can't be anything but incurious, because as soon as you start being curious, you sort of scratch the veneer of this world building, and of course it'll all fall apart. So they can't do that. They've got to go, here's the situation, though. We're like, oh great, this is the situation, yeah, this is great, oh, this is great, like that. And then they get into a new situation, it's like, oh, this is good, yeah, this is good, oh, that's great, like that. So it's a bit weird. There is actually one exception to the always happy mood, but that's Marvin, the android, the robot, who is the manic depressive robot. But then he's still really witty and talkative, and it's sort of like, if you're that depressed all the time, would you talk so much, or would you have such a good sense of humor? Because if someone's that depressive, I don't know. But it's a bit strange. I mean, it's a fun character to spend time with. Also, one thing that's very clear is that by the end of the novel, all of the characters are exactly the same at the end of the novel as they are at the beginning. For example, Arthur Dent, sort of your everyman character, he starts off by protecting his house with some help from a friend and stuff like that. And then at the end, he's protecting his brain in quite a similar kind of situation, again, with help from his friends. But it's sort of like he does feel things and care for things. So he is actually it's sort of a little... slightly more interesting. Because he is the like human character in the book, so he is has slightly more humanity and seems to care about things more than the other more cynical characters in the book. The Ford prefect is, I think he's pretty much the least interesting character in the novel, because he just sort of hangs around and he's sort of like he's only in the novel because he's a friend of Arthur. I mean, yeah, sure, he's an alien on Earth, but that's not really very interesting at all about him. Oh, he's a friend of Zaphod, the Zaphod as well. But it's like he doesn't have any. And actually, I'm just trying to think who played him in the film, because there's of course the film version that came out in I think 2004, 2005, and I can picture all the other actors, even if I can't remember all their names. Wait a second. Cast photo in the front. Let me flick to that because I can't remember. I mean, he's so forgettable that even his character in the film, I can't actually remember who it was. Let me see. Yeah. Martin Freeman? No. Ah. Mos Def. Oh, yeah, I remember now. Mos Def. Yeah. He's such an uninteresting character that they had to sort of go, oh, wait a second. We need someone who's not white and British in the cast. We'll have a black American guy in the cast or something just to make him more interesting. And even then, he's so boring. I couldn't even remember who played him in the film because he doesn't really do anything. He just sort of just hangs around and says lines which aren't funny enough for Zaphod to say. He says them instead. Anyway, then I guess, let me see here, you got Zoe Deschanel, who plays Trillian, and she's also a bit of a non-character, and actually I quite liked her a lot more in the film, because she was like a bit of a love interest, and in this book, it's really weird, maybe it's a bit weird, maybe I'm being racist about having token black characters in the film, but sometimes I can be sexist here as well, because sometimes in a story, if there's a female character there, you can always get that kind of sort of like relationship sort of love triangle thing going on, that they did actually quite well in the film, I thought. But here in the book, it's sort of like, okay, we've got this character, female, beautiful, intelligent, girlfriend of Zaphod Beetlebrox, the president of the galaxy. You think, well, this could be quite interesting, but no, she just sort of hangs out, doesn't do anything, sort of presses a button. She's like the announcer in the film Galaxy Quest. You've got the... I can't remember the name of the character, but it was Sigourney Weaver. She sort of repeats what the computer says. She just repeats it and things. So that's pretty much her character here. And I'm not sure if this is sort of like a comment on sort of like the beautiful, intelligent character in science fiction or not. But it's sort of like he did miss a trick there with it, with sort of missing out any kind of sexual tension or any kind of relationship kind of tension at all with Trillian. But again... it's not even like I think the only role for women in fiction or the only role for females in fiction should be as a love interest, but really it's sort of like it would have been nice for her to have something to do except just hanging out, which is a bit weird. And of course you've got Zaphod. Zaphod, I think, is probably my favorite character, mainly because he's like I say, more interesting. He wants to do something. He set out to achieve something, even if he's not quite sure what. And I really enjoy the passages in the book where he talks about his insecurities, because he's sort of like, yeah, he's the foodiest dude in the entire galaxy, and he's the guy to be with and stuff like that. And then you realize he's insecure and he's trying to cover it for himself and things like that. And that was quite fun. And also Marvin, the android, is also actually quite funny too, because he's very cynical and he's very morose all the time, but in a very funny way. And again, he's quite a memorable character and has a lot of good lines in the book. And there are lots of minor characters as well. And the things that he does, Douglas Adams does with the minor characters, he does very quick shortcuts to personality types, is what he does. He's like, okay, this person is going to be a policeman and he's going to say this, and immediately within two lines you understand. This person's going to be a philosopher and within one line you understand everything that you need to know about their character. Not, of course, not everything about their character. And this is a programmer, and you need like you get everything you need to know about the character of the programmer. But then only what's actually matters to tell the joke or to make do the satire or to do something like that. So it's sort of like very, very quick shortcuts into the characters. But then, like I say, you don't really need deep characters. And I guess in a series, like a radio series, you don't want the characters to change too much, because if it's a sitcom, you want to spend time with the characters. And I guess that was the key to the success of this book and the later books and the whole series, is that he could just leave the characters exactly as they are, book after book after book, because people just enjoyed hanging out with them and the situations and the weird stuff that they get into there. Unfortunately, it doesn't really make great characters for a novel, where you're sort of looking for some kind of journey for these people to go on. But like I say, there is a slight journey, but really not a lot there at all. Next up, my next note in my text document here is technology. There is quite a lot of technology mentioned, not a lot of explained, because it's not really needs to be explained. And when it is explained, it's explained in like a stupid way, which is sort of like a comment on the absurdity of the universe or the universe that you set up, and also like a comment on the absurdity of us trying to understand everything. It's sort of like there's the Babel fish, which is the translating fish that you stick in your ear so you can understand everything that's going on, all the other different languages that all the alien races are saying. You can understand them straight away, which, again, it leads to so many plot holes that, you know, there's so much stuff going on there which is probably not quite right because of this. But it's a funny way for him to have a dig at intelligent design, and at the same time, the dig at saying, like, evolution can explain everything, because, of course, it can't explain everything. There's so much other stuff going on there, which, you know, just are my own opinions here, but there's my own not very grounded opinions, but you get all these sort of, like, evolutionary psychologists to explain all of human behavior in terms of what it meant for us growing up as a species on the plains of Africa and things like that, which I think is maybe 5% of it might be true, but I think 90% of it is bullshit about that. I think it's all cultural, and I think that people learn to do or learn to fit into the situations that they come with as well. I heard this view expressed quite well, I think, on a podcast a while ago, and it's talking about people who are born with no arms and they learn to write and draw and paint and do everything just with their feet. And you're like, okay, there is no evolutionary advantage to doing all this kind of stuff with your feet, just in the same way that there wouldn't have been any evolutionary advantage for things that we do with our hands and ways that we speak or talk or think or anything like that. It's just that there is an evolutionary advantage to to be able to fit into any kind of situation, and the human's capacity to do that is that it's there. You know, it fits in this kind of way. Anyway, I think I've gone quite a long way off topic here from the Babel fish, but I think it's actually quite a good comment on scientists trying to explain away everything, and there's lots of that. That's one of the big themes of this book as well. Another great bit of technology is, of course, the improbability drive. I'm not going to go into it, how it works, but again, this sort of like a comment about the way it works. I didn't write down the page number that it's explained at, but it says that, you know, the person who invented the improbability drive did so well, or it was such a clever dick, that he got given the Clever Dick Award. And it's sort of like, yeah, Douglas Adams is sort of like giving that to himself in this way, because it's so clever, and it's such a stupid, like, language trick, almost like a language logic trick that he plays to be able to make the infinite improbability drive work, that he should get that Clever Dick Award himself. The funny thing is actually that I like about some of this technology he talks about is sort of like strangely prophetic in a way. Like I said before, like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, like it's mentioned, I think it was on the XKCD comic, where someone gets a Kindle which can look up Wikipedia, and they scratch the Kindle logo off, and it says "Don't panic" underneath or something like that. You know, that's what you have really with the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which I've talked about this beforehand. There's so many people who so many authors with science fiction who always underestimated the value of information and access to information. That's what I liked. I think I talked about it in the review that I did of Ender's Game, where they talk about like the network that they have there, and it's very much like the modern day blogosphere and internet and comments that are going on there as well. Whereas you don't get the form right. It doesn't have to be like everyone's going onto the internet. I mean, you don't name it correctly. But I do think that one of the big things that lots of people missed was the easy access to information, and that's what I really like about the actual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy itself as a concept, as the book. But while Douglas Adams drops in many references to digital watches, which was a kind of height of technology back in the 1970s, early 80s, I guess, when this whole sort of series was coming into being, what he's talking about there is sort of like, and people going, oh, I'm wearing a digital watch. Oh, how modern of me, and things like that. And he also talks a bit about like listening to radio, which uses knobs and dials, and then it's sort of like touch sensitive, and then it sort of gets, you're not even touching anymore, you're sort of waving your arms around. And I guess this is maybe a slightly easy prediction to make about the direction that technology goes to, but just putting it this way, the MP3 players that I've owned, of course, the first MP3 player that I owned was sort of like some weird SanDisk kind of thing, you know, like one of these no brand or no name players. And of course that's all sort of like flicking switches and big knobs and buttons. And then of course I got an iPod Nano, and that you press the buttons, but it's sort of slightly touch sensitive. And then I got an iPod Touch, and now an iPhone as well, and it's all touch sensitive, and there's not like any easy buttons and stuff like that. So I actually have the headphones with the button on it, so I can pause it without even touching it anymore. But like if it's not plugged in and I'm just listening to it over the speaker from the iPhone itself, like listening to some music or listening to a podcast in that way without the headphones in, every time I want to press pause, I've got to turn it on, do the touchscreen thing, and then it's sort of like lots of touchy, touch sensitive stuff as well. And I guess the next step is going to be like Douglas Adams mentioned, this sort of like waving your arms around, but then if you wave your arms around too much, it can't work and stuff. You know, you interrupt the radio station things. And I guess that's what's happening now, maybe with the Wii and the other controls for computers and things like that, and using the webcam on your laptop, and you wave it and it does different things. Like that kind of stuff is coming on now, slowly but surely. And I actually thought that was quite funny how he pretty much set out the evolution of control of MP3 players and computers just over the last few years, which is quite fun. Yeah, I guess the new Apple mouse that's come out is the Magic Mouse, which is all touch sensitive, and you're sort of all stroking and touching and stuff, kind of thing. What else did I make in my notes here? Oh, yeah, there's a big computer called the Googleplex. I think that's actually quite funny, because you get the Babelfish, which early internet users will recognize as the first translation software. I think there's AltaVista and Babelfish, which was the translation services online. Of course, you've got the Googleplex. So, of course, I do think maybe the Googleplex is, you know, Google is named after something else, but I'm thinking maybe Google is named after this. And there's, of course, lots of other things, other references in this book where technology has followed what's in this book rather than, or the names, let me put it that way, maybe the ideas has followed what's in this book rather than the other way around. Like one of the first internet encyclopedias was the H2G2, which was actually set up by Douglas Adams, I think, and then became a BBC project. And you know, so it's very strange. But there are lots of hints, like I say, lots of techno babble and lots of jargon in this book, which is actually really good fun, because in a normal science fiction book you could never get away with it, because it's got to follow some kind of rules. You've got to have some kind of logic behind everything, so you can't have like a speed. There's they at one point they travel at speed R17, and again I'm not going to give away what R17 means, but it's actually quite a funny way of measuring speed, and would only really work in a comedy novel where the rules of the universe are mutable and doesn't really matter what's going on, which normally in science fiction I would really really hate mutable laws of the universe. But in this novel I don't mind it, because every time it's there it's set up for a joke. It's not like a plot hole. I mean, it is a plot hole. There are many, many plot holes in here. But everything where suddenly the rules change or something else happens or there is a plot hole or technology is used one way then and then another way then, and different levels all playing into each other. Sometimes, well, most often in a book that I call it a weakness. But here, because every single one of these is a setup to social satire and a joke, it actually works really well, because you don't need the rules to it. So, yeah, it's very interesting. Which brings me on to the writing style. Now, as I said before at the beginning of the book, I was like, would I really enjoy this book or not? And it turns out I really did enjoy it for the third time, or at least the third time I've read this book. I guess my memory was soured by the last books in the series. I just didn't care anymore, and I thought it was a bit tedious to get through this. But this is actually really, really funny. And I go back to that thing on page 207 where it's just stuff if it's funny and if it appeals to Douglas Adams, he puts it in. So you get all these great diversions, and normally in a book, it's sort of just like plot for the sake of, well, it's not even plot, it's like backstory for the sake of no, and world building for no reason. It's just boring. Whereas this is actually, every time you go away, that's actually some of the more interesting parts of the book. And there's so many things that happen where you just think, oh, that's a bit stupid. And then, but it's a setup for a joke. And I just think it's very, very, very cleverly written and very, very funny. I guess the humor wouldn't appeal to everyone, but it really appealed to me. I found it really fun. Yeah. And for everything in the book, I think there's probably about two or three levels of comedy in every situation and every scene, and I'm probably missing half of it, you know, because that's what happens a lot of the time. If I read it again, I'd probably laugh at different things in the book, and I think that's one of the reasons why this is a classic, because I guess it can stand up to you know, repeat reading, and also stand up to replication in different media. Like I said, it started off as a radio play, it's been a book, it's been like an audiobook, it's been computer games, it was a film, it was a TV series and everything like that. And I guess I've not seen any of those, except I've not listened to the radio plays or seen the TV show. I have seen the film though, but it works really well as a novel, because the stuff that would be missing unless you have a narrator, which actually you did have a narrator, and Stephen Fry was the narrator in the he was actually the voice of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy book in the film, and you know, you did actually take some of these diversions and go off in this kind of stuff, and they're actually really, really good fun. So yeah, what else can I say about the writing? Note here, oh yeah, it's a bit strange how it's very Earth-centric, which maybe it's not, that's not strange, but I find it a little bit strange that everything is very Earth-centric, and I'm thinking, okay, is this a way that The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy ties knowledge into local knowledge, so when you're reading it, you've got like a local frame of reference? So in all the stories, it says about, it uses Earth measurements and names of Earth things, and I was thinking, no, well, that can't be, because The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy notoriously doesn't have a very interesting or lengthy entry about Earth itself, so it can't be that. And then I was thinking, wait a second, I'm really trying to find plot holes where there aren't any. I was trying to find logic where there isn't any. The reason why it's very Earth-centric is because it's not a book about space, like all good science fiction. It's a book about us. It's a book about humanity. It's a book about society. It's a book about philosophy and technology and all these different kinds of stuff, but from a very human point of view. So even though, you know, even though the Earth, not giving too much away here, the Earth is destroyed in the opening few pages of the book, it's actually very much a book about Earth and about humanity, which is actually quite cool. And then there's this other thing where I'm thinking, okay, Ford's name, Ford Prefect, it's a name he chose when he went into Earth, but then when he meets up with Zaphod again, his old friend who he knew from before he went to Earth, Zaphod calls him Ford, and it's like, wait a second. So is this, what's this? Is this the Babelfish translating, so we know that they know what each other's names are, even though they use different names? And I'm thinking, well, no, that can't be. And then I'm thinking, I'm overthinking this again. It really isn't that deep. You really don't need to stress too much out. It's stress about this too much. And actually, this is explained really well at one point where something dramatic is going to happen. And Douglas Adams, he takes a break and says, wait a second, don't worry. This is what's going to happen. This is the outcome of the situation. Don't need to stress about it. I know it's a stressful situation. What's going to happen is this, and this. And that will happen, but that's going to remain a mystery, because there has to be a mystery. And then he tells you how that happened. Now, the situation that he sets up is sort of, you know, it pertains to whales and petunias and stuff like that. And you're thinking, what's all this about? So even though he says exactly what's going to happen, or the outcome of what's going to happen, the actual journey that he gets there is the interesting part. And again, it's only like a period of 5 pages there, but that takes a lot of balls to do, just to say, actually, at the end of the chapter, this is what's going to happen. Now let's go. And it's a bit strange that he's sort of playing around with it, but the whole situation is saying, literally, don't be stressed out about it. Don't worry about it. At the end of the book, we're going to have some different stuff. It's not about like, it's not about what's going on. It's just about the journey. It's just about the fun stuff on the way. Don't be too stressed out about it. Which I guess is reflected in the words that now printed across pretty much every edition of this, which is "Don't panic," which are the words on the front of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the publication within the book as well. So that's really light. It makes you not worry too much about when you're reading. You're just like, no, don't need to worry about it. Don't need to worry about it at all. Don't think too much about it. Just enjoy the comedy and the humour. But as it comes down to it, like I say, he really can't write a story. And the characters, while fun, like I say, fun to spend time with, interesting lines, they have funny quips and things like that. No character arcs, no journeys that anyone goes on really at all, which is a bit pity. Actually, I remember reading, like, the first time I read this, and everyone talks about this. This is one of those big cultural references about taking a towel with you. As a hitchhiker, you know, you take a towel and everything will be fine. And there's this whole big part in the front of the book where, you know, it's sort of like, have you got your towel? Have you got your towel with you? And then you get like an extract from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Have you got your towel? Take your towel. This is what it's used for. It's really, really handy. And I actually remember the first time I was reading this book, getting to the end of the book and thinking, wait a second, they didn't use the towel. And I was expecting like the climax, even though there isn't really a big climax at the end of the book. You know, I was thinking, they didn't use the towel. I was expecting the towel to come in, and it hadn't been used up until then. It's sort of like, always carry your towel with you. If you've got your towel, everything's going to be fine. But then it's not used at the end of the book, and I'm just like, wow. Any other author would, if they were going to set up the towel like that at the beginning, with the, you know, Chekhov's gun on the wall and all that kind of stuff, it would have been paid off at the end. But here, no, not at all. But again, don't worry about it. That is really not what the book's about. It's not about the tale at all. Brings me on to the themes of this book. As I said before, it's very much a satire. It's very much a book about life and all that kind of stuff. But what I really enjoyed about it is it seems to be very much a book about the wonder of the universe, even though it's a fictional universe and all kind of weird stuff is happening and nothing is explained. But you get these passages in the book, which is sort of like really amazing. Like, and he conveys like the wonder of technology and the wonder of science and the wonder of nature and the wonder of the cosmos actually better than many people many science fiction authors who try and write about it in like a more clinical way or in a like a more factual way or even a more logical way, just by saying there's this great bit where he went out to this hall and he had a clear idea of what infinity looks like. And of course, and then it goes on to explain it. And just that passage, that's one of the most memorable passages of the novel for me, is sort of like the clear idea of what infinity looked like. And he goes on to explain how you could get a clear idea of infinity. And it's actually really clever. There's lots of little hints at that throughout the book, where it talks about like the vastness of space and the size of the galaxy and all these different kind of things and big numbers, you know, and all that kind of stuff is presented really well in this novel, even though, like I said, it doesn't have any things take as long as, you know, if it's funnier to say something takes 10 million years, it's going to take 10 million years. If it's funnier to say something takes 51 seconds, it's going to take 51 seconds. It doesn't have any logic to any of that kind of stuff. So, like I say, it's talking about the wonder of the universe and science without actually being scientific at all. But what I do like about it is also hints at the unknowability and the greater, like, wider cosmology. For example, at one point, one of the characters is going, oh, wait a second. So the reason I was feeling that, you know, I was had this paranoia, and that's what I was thinking about, this paranoia, because it was all this big setup. And the other person just says, no, everyone feels that paranoia. And then he's like, oh, so that means, well, if everyone feels that paranoia, maybe the entire universe is some kind of setup. And he's like, no, don't worry about that. But it's sort of like that little hint there. Just the idea that the paranoia that you have there, just that the fact that everyone feels some slight paranoia maybe means that the entire universe is, we're all living in the Matrix or something like that. And it's just put out there. And it's sort of like one paragraph or two, an A-B exchange in a conversation, and you can get that straight away, that little bit there. And also the hints, like when, you know, there's this one inanimate object and something goes through the inanimate object's mind, and they're like, and if we knew why it thought that, you know, we'd have a much greater grasp of the universe. And I'm just like, oh, great. And then he just skips on to the next chapter, and it's just a funny thing. And you think the whole payoff is going to be the whale, but actually the whole payoff to that kind of thing is actually the bowl of petunias, which is actually really good fun. But like I say, themes of the book very much is sort of like the cynicism, and also that, like, the, not just the senselessness, is sort of like the improbable events will happen. You know, improbability is a big part in the, maybe into the, in the second, definitely the second section of the, like the episode two, let me say, of this book is very much about improbability. And I quite like that kind of setup. And that's commented later on in the book in one of the later episodes, if you will. One of the ill-defined episodes later on. One of the things that is very easy about the book, and again, what it comes down to one of its great appeals as a work of fiction, is that a lot of the sort of the target of the satire of the book is very easy targets, like bureaucracy. And it's sort of like, well, that's very easy. Like the whole setup of the book that, you know, Arthur's house is going to be knocked down and he didn't know about it because the forms weren't there and the film, you know, and all these different kind of things, he didn't know about it. So that's actually quite an easy target. And also, like, when he lampoons the philosophers in their ivory tower and council workers and, you know, the police force and all these different things, and, like you say, the religion as well. But then, like you say, takes a shot at religion, but then he also talks about these best-selling books by the atheist philosopher, who might as well be Richard Dawkins, although this was written a lot before Richard Dawkins got into writing that kind of stuff. And he sort of like writes the books that disproves God once and for all. They're called something like God, Who Needs Him Anyway? God, The Final Disproof. God, and one more thing about God, or one more thing about the lack of, you know, it's that kind of setup, which is quite fun that he throws in those stabs in both directions and in all directions as well. Like I say, very a universal appeal for the themes of this novel. But again, it's really strange that after all of that, it's not the characters and not the journey that the characters go through, which gives the book the character. Let me put it this way. All of these themes are expressed very much in the secondary characters and the world of the book. But the main characters, while they do face all of this kind of stuff, they're very much sort of observers of the universe rather than doers in the universe. And again, that is a very strange kind of thing. It's sort of like the entire setup is like the characters are hitchhikers going through the galaxy, and the guide is helping them along. But really, the way that they're learning about the world is by watching it and looking at it rather than doing anything or being anything, which is a very strange way of going about it. But it, I guess it does set up a very much of an everyman kind of view of the world that again, probably appeals to a lot of people. So, to conclude, I actually really enjoyed this book. A little bit more than I thought I would, because I think it just came down to the fact I forgot how funny it was. And again, I must admit, probably the humour doesn't appeal to everyone, but it tickled me. And also, all these little things, all these little questions of philosophy and science and cosmology and all these other things that just make you think and make you think, oh yeah, that'd be interesting. But, like I say, the strength of the book is that he doesn't try and present it in a logical fashion. Like, if you wanted to get all the ideas in this book across in, like, a true science fiction book where the rules of the world were set and it had to have some kind of internal logic, it would either take a massive book and probably spread across many dimensions of space and many parallel universes just to fit it all in there, or it would just be a stand-up comedy routine. So this is actually quite a fun fun like mixture of the two, taking the tropes of one and the ideas of another, and ideas from other places and satire from other places and putting them together. But I guess, like I say, enjoyed it more than I thought I would do, and I guess that comes down to my sequel fatigue from the later novels as well. But overall, I think the lack of story and the character development, it means I don't rate it that highly as a novel. And strangely, the story itself isn't actually that great. And maybe if you're reading it for the first time, I'll just mention it. Maybe you won't like it as much, or maybe you'd like it more because everything's going to be new. Like, I remember a lot of the jokes in this. Of course, there was a lot of new stuff in that I couldn't remember, or renewed stuff that I didn't remember. But maybe if you're reading it for the first time, all the jokes will be fresh and the characters will be fresh and the situations will be fresh and you'll enjoy it a lot more. But then I warn you that if you're expecting a good story out of it, you'd be disappointed there. So, like, again, maybe if you... I'm not even sure what I'm trying to say here. I'm just saying that if this was the first time I was reading it, maybe I'd have enjoyed it more because it'd all been fresh, or maybe I've enjoyed it less because I didn't know to expect a non-satisfying ending to the book and a non-satisfying story overall. So that's my little throwing out there. So as a novel, maybe 2 stars. As a fun read, maybe 4 and a bit stars. So overall, I'm going to give it 3.5 stars. And yeah, that's it. And I'm not going to review any of the following series because I can say I remember not enjoying them that much at all. And I'm not going to read. There's a new book come out. I heard them discussing it on the Sofanauts podcast last week or the week before, whenever it was. And I probably won't bother reading that at all because I agree with their sentiments entirely. They said maybe, you know, other people shouldn't write Arthur C. Clarke. No, not Arthur C. Clarke. It was Isaac Asimov novels. You know, what he, and then they said, oh, well, Isaac Asimov shouldn't have written as many novels as he did either. And I think that might have been the case with Douglas Adams. I'm not entirely sure because of all the books that I read of his, and I read like the Dirk Gently's, what do you call it? Maybe there's a list of the books here in the front. The Detective Agency one. No, I can't find the list of his other works here. But and I read that, didn't really enjoy it very much. And the other books in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy universe, I didn't enjoy very much either. Or certainly not as much as this first one. And by the end of it, I was just bored. The film, though, I actually quite liked the film. Lots of people said, oh, the film's terrible. It didn't do what the book did, you know, and the story was different and the characters are different. But as far as I can tell, the novel was a lot different from the radio show, and the TV show was different again, and then the recast audio LPs were different too, and the computer game was different. So I just see that the film is sort of like a retelling of the story, and to be honest, the story is better, even though I didn't think it was as funny as this book, and maybe the characters aren't quite as interesting or quite as engaging because you've got to actually look at them and you've got they work at their own pace rather than at the pace you're reading it. But overall, I actually thought, is it like a better story? And people say, oh, they missed the point of it because it was a love story and stuff. It's like, well, it's a film, it's a movie. You're going to have that kind of love triangle thing going on there. And you've got to have some kind of journey for the main character, for Arthur Dent to go on. Otherwise, it's not a very good story. I mean, you can't just have like a meandering story like you do here. I mean, this book is a very unique thing that there isn't a proper long story, but then again, it didn't sell on the strength, it didn't originally sell on the strength of it being a good story. It originally sold on the strength of it being a tie-in to a very popular radio show. And the fact that it's actually very funny and it has a lot of relevance and it still holds up after many years. I mean, the only thing that's even slightly out of date in this whole novel is the references to the digital watch, and everything else is pretty much still here. 25, well, it's much more than 25. I guess it's, 30 years now, isn't it, since 1979. And everything else holds up really well. So what was I trying to say? Yeah, it's only because of its, like, genuine wide appeal that it still holds up as a novel at all, and it still becomes popular, because as a story it's lacking quite a lot, so that would have never transferred very well across as a film. So anyway, that's all I've got to say about that. The next novel I'm going to read is going to be a surprise to you and to me, because I'm not quite sure what I'm going to read next at all. I've got a few books there, but I might read another fantasy book, I might read the Bible, I might write my own novel, actually concentrate on that for another few days. Otherwise, thanks a lot for listening. You can email me with your experiences with this book, or not at all. Email me luke@juggler.net. Also, check out, once they actually put it out, which will probably be in a few weeks' time, check out the Geek Nights. Go to frontrowcrew.com and check out the Geek Nights book club episode that they'll do, and they'll give their own opinions of this book as well, so do that too. You can recommend books to me and follow what I'm reading along at goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. Follow me on Twitter, which is Luke Burridge. I'm that at Twitter. Otherwise, keep in touch with keep up with what I'm doing on Twitter, and of course on my blog, which is lukeburridge.com/blog. And also, keep an eye out for a video that I'm releasing, and I'll be putting that on my blog and probably mention it on the next podcast if I've put it out there so far. I think you'll enjoy it because it's literally, like I said before, all the places that I've been this year packaged into a little 3.5 minute long video for you to enjoy, which is, like I said, it's been like an eight or nine month project. No, longer than that. 10.5 month long project for me, this video and stuff like that. So I'm quite proud of it. So hopefully you'll enjoy that too. Otherwise, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.